time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and a couple of guests for you, David Drake and Jamie Knack. David's an Extension wildlife specialist and professor. David, good to see you.
Hi, Larry. Nice to see you.
Jamie Knack is an Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist, and Jamie, good to see you as well.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
They're both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus, so we'll talk with them about a lot of things, fall hunting seasons, feeding birds in winter. There's some talk about some apps that are available to help you out, and a whole lot more, and I hope you join in. You can call in with your questions or comments to 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email and maybe a wildlife photo to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Well, fall, to me, is the best time to get outside of the whole year. And if you're out there, it's nice to be able to identify what you're seeing. And there are some apps for that. David, let's start with you. Tell us about some of those apps.
Yeah, there's a number of them out there, Larry, and it seems like there's more and more every year. But a couple that I like to highlight that I use almost daily, one is iNaturalist. And iNaturalist is essentially a citizen science reporting portal, and it's on the internet. You can either do it via your home computer, or you can download the app to a smartphone. And essentially, under this iNaturalist umbrella, anybody can create a project-specific page under that iNaturalist umbrella. And so you have people who are citizen scientists who are just members of the public collecting scientific data and adding it to this database under iNaturalist umbrella. And you have things, pages for geology, for phenology, for astronomy, plants, wildlife, seasons, weather, all sorts of different things. And iNaturalist has got 85 million observations recorded on that app by 4.7 million unique individual users, and over 345,000 species have been observed and recorded. Wow. It is a wonderful, wonderful app. I use it all the time in some of the research I do with the UW Urban Canid Project, where we have got a project-specific page. And we ask anybody in the Madison area who sees a red fox or coyote to go to our project-specific page under the iNaturalist umbrella and report that sighting. And it is very, very helpful to us in order to understand where these animals are moving across the landscape in the Madison area. We use it to kind of target areas of the city where we might want to try to trap animals and things of that nature. So That's one of my favorite ones is iNaturalist. And then the other one that I'd like to talk about is Merlin. And Merlin is a bird identification app. It's not necessarily a citizen science app like iNaturalist is, but it's a bird identification app. And again, it's something you can download to your home computer or more conveniently download to your smartphone, be it a Droid or iNaturalist. And it's through the Lab of Ornithology through Cornell University. And essentially what this is it's a bird book that is on your phone. And so you can download different packages through the Merlin app for eastern part of the United States, western part of the United States, different parts of the world, and things of that nature. And it just has phenomenal amount of information on there, essentially because you have this large database that you can add a bunch of different information. But they have great pictures to help you identify the bird. They've got information about the conservation status of the birds. They've got information about habitat, where the range of these animals. And what I particularly enjoy about the app relative to a bird book is that they have songs and calls on the app that you can use if you hear a bird but you don't see it. For example, you can say, I think it is a pine warbler, and then you can go to the pine warbler identification page on that app, play the song, and you say, oh, yep, that is the pine warbler, or no, it's not the pine warbler. It's, for example, maybe it's something, you know, to me, boring like an English sparrow. So those are a couple of my favorite apps that I use. I use almost daily, and Merlin I use very, very regularly.
Jamie Knack, what about you?
Yeah, I should just add, David, I don't know how many people are familiar that there's a new sound function with the Merlin Bird ID. So now you can take out that phone and you're hearing a bird in the backyard. And so this is when, you know, David and I get the calls on radio. Oh, it sounded like this, or it sounded like that. And we're trying to figure out what that bird is. If you take out your phone and record, so you go into the Merlin Bird app and you record a little snippet of that song, it will come back with what it believes that that bird is. And you're programming your app to be based on your location. And obviously not all the songs are in there, but pretty common birds, they're kicking back. And to me, as a, now I had to learn all these bird songs in college, but it's something you don't retain if you don't use so regularly. But boy, these are so nice to confirm. So you hear that bird singing, you record, and like, oh yeah, it is a rufous-sided towhee. I was right. So I just wanted to add that. So I think that's a real benefit from downloading the Merlin Bird ID. The other one I wanted to mention is there's one called Seek, and it's S-E-E-K, and it's actually by iNaturalist, but it helps you in that you can take pictures. So you download the app, and then you can use the camera function to take photos of plants or mushrooms or insects or animals. And you can take multiple pictures of that plant. So looking at the stem, the flower, the leaf, the bark, and it will continue to try to take that information and get it down to a species level. Sometimes maybe it only gets into the family. So maybe a goldenrod, it just tells you it's Solidago, but it doesn't tell you specifically which goldenrod. But again, this helps you in the field. And so where I've found it to be helpful is working with private landowners. So we're walking a property and, hey, that looks like garlic mustard. And I can show them on the app, yes, that is garlic mustard, or that's buckthorn, or that's honeysuckle. Or hopefully in the case of some of the natives, we can help them identify tree species and so on. So that one is called Seek. It's by iNaturalist. So actually, if you start to record your confirmed observations, you can then upload them into the citizen science platform that David was talking about a little bit earlier. They're completely connected. So, and I have a few others, but maybe want to take a pause and we can always come back to it if there's time.
We'll sprinkle those in along the way. In the meantime, we have callers online, and Michael in Bear Valley, we'll go to you first. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Larry, really enjoy your show. I read this article this morning about the COVID-19 issue with deer in Iowa. Apparently, it was in the New York Times. Apparently, they were looking at CWD samples from last year, and they found that 80% of the samples were infected with COVID-19. And I was wondering if your guests could comment on that, especially in light of the deer hunting season opening up and the risk of handling deer, and also just the general picture of how this virus has spread from apparently bats to humans to mink to deer, and who knows what's next, like pets. Anyway, thank you.
All right. I had not heard about COVID spreading to deer.
Yeah, so Michael, I apologize. I too am not up to speed on that. So that is definitely something I'm going to look into after today's show. You do bring up important things that we wanted to talk about, though, in terms of chronic wasting disease testing. And again, that certainly is a disease that is still prevalent on the landscape. And we always encourage hunters, especially if they're in areas with prevalence, to be testing their deer and submitting the samples to get those test results prior to consuming. So again, I apologize. Maybe there'll be others on that will call in and share some, but I need to do some more digging into that. So
yeah, I'm not current with that story either, Michael. So I'm going to look into that as well after the show, but I think it just goes to show how little we know about COVID-19 and how it spreads. I think there's relative certainty that certainly it originated in a bat species in China, and then as a zoonotic disease or a disease that can jump across species lines, it went from a bat species to humans. But if you recall early on, they thought maybe pangolins were involved with this, and certainly minks seem to be susceptible in other species. But again, you know, even within the human population, they're not quite sure exactly how COVID-19 moves through the human population and why they see peaks sometimes and declines in the COVID-19. And so I think there's still a lot that's left to be determined about how this disease moves through a variety of different species.
Yeah, and we're just starting to look too, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know if our Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources will be looking to see about deer and COVID-19 when they do their testing. But if we think about like the West Nile virus, we weren't looking for it in rough grouse until the last, couple of years. So,
right.
It's just constantly evolving and now we know to look.
Yep. And the more you look, the more you find sometimes. Yeah. That's right.
And it reminds me the hunting seasons are in full force, at least for deer. Bow hunting is on right now and other seasons as well.
Yeah, they are. So we had a number of topics that kind of crossed this fall hunting season time frame. One of the things I wanted to just mention is that if you are at all interested in maybe pursuing the idea of hunting, there are opportunities for you to do a mentored hunt or to participate in the mentored hunting program. And so that's for anybody, regardless of your age, if you've never held a hunting license. So, so as long as you haven't already completed a hunter education course, you can be mentored. And then the mentor themselves, they have to be over 18, or if it's a younger mentee, parent or guardian has to give parental approval. And then the person who is the mentor has to have had hunter education or be exempt because of their date of birth, which is anyone in the state who is born on or after January 1st of 1973 is required to have hunter education. So in addition to opportunities to try hunting in the mentored program, there are also learn to hunt programs. And so those you can find out about them, and they're learn to hunt deer, learn to hunt pheasant, learn to hunt raccoon, squirrel, all sorts of species specific programs where you get content about that particular species, their biology, the regulations. You get experience, whether it's a shotgun or a rifle, practicing with the firearm, and then an opportunity to go out and pursue that animal with a mentor. And then the DNR also has some focused programs for more geared towards newer adult hunters or families with a focus on sustainable harvest of wild game. And those are called hunt for food programs. And so all of these programs, if you have any interest at all about exploring them, go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and type in mentored hunting or learn to hunt, and you'll get to those pages to see what opportunities are out there.
I remember taking the hunter education program with my daughter because she had to go through it. And so I took it too, just to take it. And it was a really good experience. I enjoyed doing it and passing the test with 100%.
Yeah. I'm a hunter education instructor myself. And what I always encourage people and families, especially, your children may or may not become hunters, but what hunter safety or hunter education is also a firearm safety course. And that knowledge of how to handle firearms and be safe around firearms is really pretty priceless. So if nothing else, you get that out of it and you learn a little bit more about how we manage wildlife populations as well. So
let's go to Gary in Milwaukee. Gary, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I live in West Dallas, and it's a nice area where lots of trees and things like that for birds, and I've seen a few hawks in the area. I've been living there for about 5 years. Noticed, there's a few owls in the area because you can hear them hooting at night. And in fact, you can see them from sometimes on the treetops when there's no leaves in the winter. About a month ago, stepped out my back door. Kids are sleeping, nice and quiet. Walk out. I hear something rushing through the trees. I look to my left, and I caught a glimpse of some feathers. I started backing up and went back in my house. As soon as I close my sliding door, I hear something hit the door. Boom. I look, and I see these feathers going back towards the trees. Do owls sometimes attack humans for non-provoked?
Well, usually when you get an attack like that from a bird, it's because of nesting. I'm trying to think if there's owls nesting right now, David.
Well, yeah, there's a, so I've not heard of that. So that's an uncommon incident that you report. It's not uncommon with other birds. So for example, if you have a barn swallow nest that's near your front door, you'll commonly get, you know, dive bombed by the barn swallows who are trying to protect the nest and the territory they're on. And I've assumed, like you do, Larry, that what's going on is that owl is probably on its territory and for some reason viewed you as some kind of an intruder or somebody who he didn't like, and it's likely a male owl he didn't like in the territory. So great horned owls are calling right now. Barred owls are calling, but great horned owls in particular, they're the earliest bird species that nest in the state of Wisconsin. Usually by the end of January, early February, they have young. So they would be on territory now. I hear them calling, when I'm laying down in bed at my house in a suburban area of Madison. So that would be my guess, is that you inadvertently stepped into the territory of an owl that is trying to protect, nesting area in this territory.
Okay, there you go, Gary. Thank you for calling. Mike in Coon Valley, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
One is a couple days ago, a neighbor of ours arrowed a three-antlered buck. And I was kind of wondering how prevalent that was. We had seen pictures of him from the last 2 years. Found his sheds last year, except for the third antler. And I've seen the buck up close, and it definitely has three buttons. So it's three antlers, not just a weird growth coming off of one. And then I'm wondering what the legality is of cutting off antlers from dead deer that have been hit by cars, as we use them for our business. We know friends that make jewelry out of antlers.
Okay, let's see. Jamie, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, thanks for the call and the questions, Mike. So I was going to ask you about what you referred to as buttons. So pedicels, that's the platform in which the velvet growth starts to grow from. So, very interesting. I would say I have seen photos of three. I can remember one from Michigan that made the news a couple years ago. And in terms of, you know, I can't give you a percentage of how rare it is, but I would say it is definitely not common, but it does happen. So similar to having an albino or a piebald or a completely dark-faced white tail. So what causes it? I don't know. Again, we could take a look at that in the literature and see if there's anything physiologically that it, you know, points to that answer. So, and then as far as legalities, you know, this has evolved over the last couple of decades in terms of what you can and can't do with roadkill. And part of it has been trying to be a little bit more flexible with roadkill so that resource can be utilized. So for instance, if you have a small game license and come across a raccoon, that license is your permission to possess that animal in season. So that encourages people to maybe clean it up if they're able to utilize the fur, or if it was a freshly harvested, killed animal, you could potentially use the meat from it. I was just looking this up for deer and bear and turkey, and I know this is a little off of what you were asking, but if you do hit either a deer, bear, or turkey, or come across a scene where somebody else has, you can now claim that animal by simply going into the Wisconsin DNR's webpage and filling out an online registration before you pick it up, before you take it into your possession. So you can register that animal, and then that confirmation number is your possession number. And that works for deer, turkey, and bear. I am not 100% sure the legalities of cutting those antlers off, because the question comes, where did you get those? Where's your registration for that deer? So I think it would be best for you. So maybe there's the possibility to register that deer and take the entire deer and then cut the antlers off and dispose of the carcass. But I would suggest that you contact the local conservation warden to get clarity on what you can and can't do. I don't believe you'd be able to just cut those antlers off and have them without some registration
involved.
Number.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There you go, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today, Natalie Guyette, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor David Drake and Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Questions or comments, experiences to share, give a call at 800-642-1234, email to ideas at WPR.org. Louise emailed information in from the November-December issue of Big River Magazine, which I haven't read yet, a survey of white-tailed deer in four states, including Illinois, found that about 40% had COVID-19 antibodies, indicating that they've been infected with the coronavirus. None appeared sick. The virus is mostly found around the animal's mouth, nose, and throat, not in the parts of the animal that are usually eaten. So that information from an emailer, Louise. So thanks for that, Louise. Appreciate it. I'll have to get out my copy of Big River and take a look.
Well, and that would make sense, being found around the mouth, nose, and throat, since it's a respiratory disease. And so, yeah, I'll have to look into that as well.
Don in Bayfield County, we go to you now. Hi, Don.
Hello. Hey, when geese molt their wings, they cannot fly. Is that also true of turkeys?
I don't know. I don't believe so. So typically that's a waterfowl phenomena. So and geese in particular, it's called dump molting, where they will dump all of their flight feathers at one time, and then they're rendered flightless for about a 28-day period, usually end of the spring, early summer when the geese do that. But other birds that are flight-capable birds, so songbirds, and I think this is true for turkeys. I'm pretty sure turkeys are not dump molters, that they will typically molt one flight feather, and then as that grows back in and is becoming functional again, then they'll molt the next flight feather and so forth, so on, until they've molted all of the flight feathers for that season. So turkeys, I don't believe, are dump molters. I think they molt sequential flight feathers like most other flight-capable birds do.
There you go. Thank you so much, Don. Marty in Lake Nabagamon, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Hey, good morning, everybody. I may be asking something that is unanswerable, but let me try anyway. Larry, you actually may know the answer to this. So whenever I drive into town, I go by this really great billboard that says, "Real hunters don't hunt, don't kill wolves." I can't tell you who sponsors it. I don't remember just off the top of my head. But it got me thinking about the wolf hunt. Anybody know what's happening with that now? The numbers, whatever? And oh, my God, someone's laughing. Okay. And my other question was, again, do you know what's the percentage of Wisconsin people hunt? Does anybody know that? Is it 10%? Is it 90%?
Sure.
I'm happy to tackle both of those here. So let's start with the latter one, less controversial. So I believe the number, so it is less than 10%. It's probably around 5 or 6% of Wisconsin citizens who partake in hunting. So nationwide, there's about 7% or so, something right around there, but certainly less than 10. And then in terms of the current or the plans for a wolf hunting season, it is basically on hold. So if you are following along in the number of, you know, turns and
That's why I was laughing. Is where do you start in telling this story?
Right. So if you were aware that there were some lawsuits, the Dane County judge issued a preliminary injunction that blocks the wolf hunt in Wisconsin. And so the second lawsuit that was out there was by the Ojibwe and six Wisconsin Ojibwe tribes, and it was against the DNR and the Natural Resources Board. The judge hearing that case was a federal judge, and on this past Friday, declined to issue a ruling on a preliminary injunction requested by the tribes. And essentially because the Dane County judge has already, you know, had the injunction. But there are concerns about discrimination against the Ojibwe tribes, with some, you know, perceived, or, you know, their concern is that they were, was asked to nullify the Ojibwe's chair. And essentially, I think, you know, what we're hearing from the Dane County judge kind of is where things stand, is that the department does have the authority to hold the season, but that there needs to be some additional time to develop a current wolf management plan and to set what that population goal is. And that hasn't been done to this point. So we have an injunction. No tags have been issued, to my knowledge. I think the DNR just kind of halted that whole process. So,
and there we are. Jamie, do you, since you brought up the what you referred to as the Ojibwe share, do you want to just briefly explain what that?
Let me see quickly if I can find what the Voight decision actually.
Well, and as you're doing that, maybe I'll
pull
the time really quick. So, There's co-management between the state, which is represented as the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and the first people or Native American Indians, however you'd like to refer to that. And so with things like wolves, the tribes have a set quota that they are provided in terms of harvesting wolves, and essentially it's 50% of the quota. But the tribes, because the wolf is a sacred animal to tribal tradition and their history, that they don't harvest any wolves ever, especially for the current wolf harvest that's been going on within the last 10 years or so. And so that's what Jamie's referring to as the Ojibwe share. And so there has to be co-management, and there's a lot of legal wrangling over what that looks like and what that means.
So there we have it, Marty. Thank you very much for that question. Appreciate it. By the way, you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, we got a nice photo of a bull elk and the Lena, I think it was, says, saw this behemoth elk tonight by the airport in Wisconsin Rapids with two doe deer. Didn't even flinch when with us parking and taking pictures. It's a pretty nice picture of that elk.
It's a pretty nice elk, too. Yeah.
Yeah. And if it was running around with white-tailed deer, doe deer, there's no possibility that an elk and a doe deer would have a little one.
You can never say never, but right. I don't believe that's a common occurrence for sure. But
no, but it could. I mean, all the parts fit, so it could. Right. It could happen, and they're all cervids, you know. So yeah, it could happen.
Okay, so it could happen. But it reminds me about the elk sightings. There have been some elk sightings in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so if you're familiar with the restoration of elk in Wisconsin, so they certainly were a native species. They were extirpated, which means they, because of overhunting and changes in the habitat loss and changes in habitat, elk were completely removed from the state, and over time restored in two distinct populations, one in Clam Lake, which is our longest standing population, and then a newer herd that's been established in Jackson County. And so northern Wisconsin, kind of western Wisconsin, and of recent, we've had sightings of bulls. So these are typically young bull elk that are leaving their home ranges. Natural behavior at this time of the year, it's breeding season. They're looking for cows in this case, cow elk, female elk, and are kind of mobile. And so there's been sightings both on trail cameras and like the caller who sent us the her own photograph in southwestern and southeastern Wisconsin. So I know Washington County, Sauk and Richland County, there were two young bulls that were seen in Lone Rock and Reedsburg. And where she's talking about by the airport, but I know the Wisconsin Rapids Police Department had a photo of I think it was probably dash cam video of a bull elk. So, you know, this is exciting news. It's wonderful for the conservation of elk in the state. It's also really important that we are aware as we approach hunting seasons. It's unfortunate, but there are misidentifications by hunters every year, unintentional, but it happens. But it's important that hunters be aware and properly take the time to identify their target side by side. There's no, you know, it's very hard to misidentify an elk, but it happens. So keep in mind, elk are going to have a shorter tail. They're much taller. They generally have black, their legs are much darker. Their antlers, if they have them, and these ones that are roaming tend to be the bull elk, their antlers are kind of swept back. And the big characteristic too is the white rump. So if you are familiar with the term wapiti, that's the Shawnee and Cree Indian word, and the meaning is white rumped. So just some things to be aware of. Make sure you identify that animal, especially if you're in those areas where elk have been roaming around.
Steve from Superior called but couldn't stay on the line. He was wondering what happened with the woodcock migration this year. It never seemed to happen. And I think, the kind of weather conditions and so forth have had an effect on migration of a lot of species, Jamie.
Yeah. So this one kind of personally gets me because the season, I believe, must close maybe Saturday. It closes like right away here in early November for the woodcock. And typically they're just kind of making their way down. So in the last 2 weeks spending time, and in fact, yesterday probably flushed about five of them. They're really here right now, but that warm late August weather that we had this, warm September, it seems like it's really delayed migration for some of those short distance migrants. And, I too am kind of disappointed it's going to be a short woodcock season. Another thing to make you aware of if you want to try to follow the woodcock migration is the Ruffed Grouse Society, also the American Woodcock Society, maintains a migration map on their website. So you can go onto that and they kind of track the migration through the U.S. of woodcock based on sightings. So that might be kind of fun to take a look at.
Yeah, for sure. Ben emailed in regard to comments on hunting for food. He says hunting is not about putting food on the table. It's more about entertainment, in his opinion. It's a business in the entertainment economy, and wonders, is it good or bad? Should lots of money be involved in this in many respects?
I'm not sure I understand completely his question or his comment, but I would just say that what we've seen in national surveys for motivations on why people hunt, the motivation that has continued to trend up is hunting for food. So I am a hunter, we hunt for food, not out of necessity. So it's not subsistence hunting where we have to hunt in order to obtain food. I have the means to go to the supermarket and buy meat, right? But the motivation to have that high quality, high protein, local food, know where your food came from type thing is of value to hunters and is a motivating factor more so now than it has been even in the future. And that's what these programs are really focusing on is adults who are conscious of where their food is coming from, really get into that. I'll tell you, our family's gotten very interested now in kind of processing we always process our own deer, but now, processing burgers, processing we've been canning venison, things like that, where we're not necessarily taking it to a processor where the meat is combined with other people. We're kind of from field all the way to, it never leaves our kitchen once it gets home. So anyway, I think that's, you know, that's part of it.
We should say, I mean, obviously deer hunting, for example, is a big driver of the economy and certainly local economies in some areas of the state. And so that's not to be lost in that comment that it is very important to the economy, for sure. And then it does trickle down in terms of, you know, people traveling to go hunting and staying overnight and buying meals and things like that. So it is and can be an important economic driver, especially to local economies as well.
Thanks again, Ben, for that email question. You could email us as well at ideas@wpr.org, or you could phone us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife today here in our state, Larry Mueller here with my guest David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Great to have both of them back. And certainly if you want to join in questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us your question and or wildlife photo to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Mike in Vilas County, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Great show. I was just calling in. I heard the caller on people not believing that people hunt for the food. And actually, you know, I love the outdoors. I spend a lot of time hiking, but for me, I hunt for the food for my health because I've got heart issues, and my cardiologist told me that I'm not supposed to be eating red meat, but I can eat all the venison that I want. And, you know, so that's really an important part of my diet, not just because, you know, it's a money thing, but because it's a health thing. And that's the same reason I hunt grouse. And then the only other comment I had just to make is that in Vilas County, when we're talking about, like, moose identification or elk identification, I think it's important to say I worked for the DNR one time. I've been retired for 10 years, but all the wolf sightings that I had up here, 99% of them turned out to be coyotes. And the only two wolves or sightings that I went to that were wolves were actually called in as mountain lion sightings. So I think it's really important for people really to learn ahead of time, you know, about critters and what they look like in their tracks. But I thank you for the show.
Oh, Mike, thank you very much for calling. Comment, Jamie?
Sure. No, definitely appreciate and concur with the comment. It seems like some of these species would be fairly easy to distinguish apart between each other. But again, you know, we're looking at them side by side, say a whooping crane versus a sandhill crane or a trumpeter swan versus a snow goose when we're looking at the identification. And in the field, you don't necessarily have them side by side. But it is absolutely the responsibility of the hunter, you know, to make that to study up and to make that proper identification. And if they're not sure, to simply not pull the trigger.
Yep, there you go. Mike, thank you so much for calling. Dennis in Green Bay will go to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. I used to deer hunt and was an avid hunter until he started baiting and then changed all of the patterns that the deer were moving. And basically where I was hunting in Marinette County, you wouldn't see anything all day and you knew there were deer. They just came out at night. And I'm wondering where we're at with baiting and if that's something that we're going to get rid of. And with chronic wasting disease being so prevalent that, you know, deer go into piles and lick each other and stuff. Is that something that the DNR is trying to get rid of, or where are we at with that?
Jamie?
Sure. So, Dennis, the authorization to bait and feed is a legislative authority. So the department doesn't control that. It has to be a legislative change to have a ban on baiting and feeding statewide. That being said, as a result of having chronic wasting disease in counties where wild deer have tested positive or captive deer have tested positive, or counties that are within, I believe it's a 10-mile radius of a positive. So if it's a county, if a positive is found on the border of two counties, both counties would be affected by the ban. So if you went to the Department of Natural Resources website, did a search for baiting and feeding ban, you'll see the 72 counties, and the ones will be shaded where there's a current ban in place. And I believe it's more than half of the counties have that ban in place. And what's interesting is, you know, hunters are aware of this for the most part, but, you know, there's other folks who feed and watch wildlife. And I'm thinking about it right now. I had seen a Facebook post where somebody was offering to get rid of pumpkins or were feeding pumpkins to their deer. And that's something where you have to be careful. You need to look to see if you're in a county where that can actually occur. So hunters and non-hunters, again, baiting is for hunting purposes, feeding wildlife watchers. In either case, these counties don't allow for it as because of a risk of spreading chronic wasting disease. But in terms of a statewide ban, I haven't heard any initiatives of late to enforce that. And again, that would have to come through legislative action.
Yeah, you wonder. I mean, there are pumpkin patches all over the place. If it was a deer eating in a pumpkin patch, well, that's not really set up to be feeding deer, just like a cornfield isn't.
So I would think that, Larry, is a lot like a food plot, right? So food plots are legal. It's an agricultural practice to grow pumpkins. That's fine. But to take your pumpkins off your porch and to put them in the backyard for the deer, if you're in a county where you can't feed or bait, that would not be legal. And so people might be thinking about bird feeding as this spills over to, you know, feeding the birds or the squirrels. If you're in a county with a ban, it's fine for you to continue to feed those animals, but you have to do so in a way that food is inaccessible to deer. So you maybe can't feed with a platform feeder right on the ground. You need to raise that feeder to make it out of reach for deer. And again, these are all precautions to prevent the spread of disease.
I was going to say the distinction typically between a bait pile and a food plot is the food plot is more dispersed. It's spread out across the landscape, whereas the bait pile is concentrated. And typically, once the food plot is eaten out, then the food is gone until the next growing season, whereas with bait piles, they're continually replenished. And so I think those are a couple of the distinctions between what would be termed and defined as a bait pile versus a food plot. And food plots are perfectly legal. Bait piles are not, depending on where you are in the state, as Jamie defined.
James in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, James.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Just calling in to get a little bit of information on the duck and goose migration coming through Dane County and what that's looking like this year.
I'll take this. I've felt a little guilty this morning. Jamie's been carrying the show here. So I think everything is delayed. We've had such nice, warm weather this fall, and it has been absolutely wonderful. But one of the consequences of that is that things are delayed. And typically for migration, the same thing for hibernation, is it's day length that is the primary driver of that. As the day length starts shortening, birds and other animals start preparing for winter, however they're going to combat winter, be it migration, hibernation, staying here and being active year round. So day length is the primary driver of that. But then obviously with day length comes colder temperatures, perhaps changes in weather, precipitation, wind direction, things like that. And even though we've had shorter day length as we have every year, same time of the year, that weather has been very, very mild. And as a matter of fact, has been warmer than usual. And so, you know, the wildlife are saying, well, I'll stick around for a little while longer because it's still a pretty nice spot to be here. And you know, I'm not being forced to leave yet to go south. And so everything is delayed. But one thing you might be able to want to do if you want to start watching for that, if you don't have time to go out to some of the local wetlands or lakes or something like that, is go on eBird. And a lot of times people are posting pictures or accounts of birds on eBird, and you can just watch the number of accounts or postings that are talking about migration in terms of the species you're interested in. And as those accounts start increasing, then you can go out and you should have a better chance of seeing migrating ducks and geese.
And let's thank you, James, for that question. Corey in Ashland, on to you now. Hi, Corey.
Hey, how you doing? Great show.
Thank you.
I just had a question. When the DNR finally goes to all the trouble of coming up with a wolf number that needs to be killed, isn't it kind of a waste of time knowing that that number will only be realized, half will be realized due to the tribes? And knowing that, why can't they just double the number or give the tribes half of their the same number that they would with a certain time to utilize those tags, or they get relinquished back so the original kill goal is realized? I'll hang up and listen. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for calling. Jamie, you wanted to pipe in there. Go
ahead. Sure. Corey, really appreciate the question. I think you're not alone in the ask, but it really comes down to we, the state of Wisconsin, has a legal obligation to include the tribal declaration in establishing those harvest goals. And so the case that we're referring to is from 1983. It's commonly referred to as the Voight decision. And it was a trial on tribal rights. And Judge Barbara Crabb saw the tribes and non-Indians as competitors for the same resource. And in this case, it was about walleye. But this, you know, decision extrapolates to other wildlife as well. So her ruling affirmed off-reservation hunting and gathering rights for tribes in the ceded territories of Wisconsin and about the northern one-third of the state. And it established a 50-50 split on the resource between the parties. So we need to manage, we again, the state of Wisconsin, the Department of Natural Resources needs to manage the wolf population, one, based on science, but also with cultural input, right? And that cultural input is this Voight decision. So if the science says we can harvest 130 wolves, then that's what the quota is. We can't elevate that and say we can harvest 260 because that's not based on science. So we have to follow the science and honor the court decision.
And I'll throw in there cultural sensitivity and respect for co-management and respect for the tribes and you know what their history and traditions are as well.
Yeah. They're in a, I mean, it, the wolf management is very, I don't know how there, I don't believe there is, you know, I don't think anybody, there isn't a win for everybody, right? Because the tribes do not believe in harvesting the wolf because they see the wolf as their brother. And if you're not familiar with that story, it behoove you to take a look at that. They essentially see it as killing a family member. And so they will always be zero for take on wolves. And, you know, we would like on the state side, some more opportunity to manage depredation and conflict, human wildlife conflict with wolves. So it is really a hard issue.
And I'll say what makes this difficult also is it's an emotional issue.
Mm-hmm.
And people's emotions and there's a lot of preconceived bias in this as well. And it makes it very difficult to manage this issue because of that. And you know, if you substitute the wolf for a squirrel and take the emotion out of this, I don't think it's as complicated as it's become simply because it's the wolf.
And it was very highly charged when that Voight decision, I can remember doing programs on it, and I can remember having a DNR representative, a member of the tribe, and a member of a fishing organization. It was turned out to be quite a good conversation. But believe me, there was a lot of arguing and a lot of fighting and some dangerous situations over a walleye at that time. Well, good conversation there. And Mark from Wautoma wonders about wolf hunting referred to as a harvest. He doesn't mind deer hunting being called a harvest because they use the meat, but when it deals with wolves, it doesn't seem like a harvest to him.
Well, I'll just start off on this one. You know, harvest, the connotation behind a harvest is there's some science behind it, and it's a sustainable harvest. So I think that's part of, and again, you know, we get dinged on the show when we talk about harvest, call, hunt, you know, essentially it's killing an animal, and depending on how you want to term it. But the harvest, the connotation behind that is there's a science behind it, and it's a sustainable management practice.
We will continue our discussion with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. David, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Jamie Knack, also a member of that department, but is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Hope you'll join in with your questions and comments and talk about the hunts. We can talk about apps. We can talk about whatever's going on in the outdoors with our wildlife. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at wildlife in our state, Larry Mueller here with regular guests Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie's an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. David, an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor. Both are affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus. Wildlife questions, I hope you'll join in. Maybe an experience to share. Give a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. And Denise from Boyd, Wisconsin sent a photo of bears in a tree. Last week, Denise was on her morning walk and saw six bears in a tree about 200 feet off the main road. It looked like a sow with five cubs. Is this possible? Yes, indeed, it is.
I'll grab this one. Give Jamie a breath there. So they can have up to five cubs, but typically the average litter size is about maybe, I think, two or three, something like that. And bears have litters every 2 years. So, you know, those after the first year or so, especially the male cubs will start getting pushed out of that natal territory. So it is possible that that's what the case is. I know, you know, with other animals like red fox, for example, and other, you know, bird species, things like that, that they will actually adopt orphaned young. And that also might be the case, is that perhaps something happened to the mom and the sows possibly got adopted or absorbed by that female that she sees in the tree there. But yes, it is possible that one female could have five cubs.
Well, I can remember playing in a golf tournament in Saskatchewan some years back, and I was on a fairway, and here comes a black bear with two cubs, and we were quite a ways away yet from the bear, but the bear just, the sow woofed, and those two cubs went up a tree faster than anything I could imagine. I mean, they just ran up that tree, and they are very capable of climbing a tree very fast. So Denise was wondering about could they climb the tree, they can definitely climb the tree as
for
well.
For a big animal, they are very quick and very adept.
Oh, man, I couldn't believe it. I mean, they were like a dead run up that tree. It was absolutely amazing to me. Sue wanted to know, wonder, why hasn't the elk population grown in Wisconsin, and wonders, is Wisconsin still an ideal location for these types of herds? And I guess she's referring, you know, the elk were released in the far north in Wisconsin quite a few years ago now, and I think she is doesn't feel that the population has grown much.
Well, I'll take that one as well really quick. So as Jamie mentioned earlier in the show, elk are native species of Wisconsin, so they belong here. They're very capable of living in Wisconsin, as is currently being demonstrated. They can be a relatively urban adapted animal. If you go up to parts of Calgary and Banff and things like that, that elk are wandering through the town of Banff quite regularly. And unfortunately, sometimes you have negative human elk interactions up there as well when people get too close to the elk. So they can certainly live in Wisconsin. They were extirpated, as Jamie mentioned, so that means that they were extinct, not throughout all of their range and for the entire species, but sometimes they become extinct throughout parts of their range, and that's what extirpation means. In 1995, the elk were brought back into Wisconsin, and that was the first reintroduction in Clam Lake. And then I think it was 2015, I believe, they were a second population, reintroduction population was established in central Wisconsin around the Black River Falls area or Jackson County, as Jamie had mentioned earlier. So, and the elk population is growing. They had the first elk hunt in 2018 since the reintroduction. So that's an indication that the population is large enough that it actually can sustain some harvest or some removal of individuals. And I think another indication that the population is growing is that they are starting to see some of these younger bull elk in southern parts of the state. And that's an indication that the number of elk are growing and kind of exceeding the areas where they're living. And those young bull elk are starting to get pushed out of those territories. And they're having to go seek some other areas where elk are less plentiful.
Mm. Jamie, you were going to add something?
Sure. Yeah. I can just add a little bit too, Sue. You know, I think there was hope that the herd, especially the Clam Lake herd, would grow at a faster rate than it did. But we did have issues with a couple of things, predation. So by both wolves and black bears, and also vehicle collisions. If you're in that Clam Lake area, you'll notice there's a lot of elk crossing signs, some of which I don't know if they still have them, but they had collars on some of the elk that as they approached that area, it would trigger the sign to start flashing. But in a relatively small population, just losing a few animals can really impact your growth. So they have seen anywhere from just 30%, which doesn't seem like that much, but that's on the high end. So a 30% positive growth year to as low as minus 16% since 1995. So, you know, there's a lot of other factors there too. I know baiting and feeding was an issue up there as well. They worked really hard with the local residents to not feed or bait. You can't really bait elk because there wasn't a hunting season at the time. But to feed elk, they had lost, I want to say it was like 3 bulls that had crossed a river to come to this food source and had broken through and drowned. So, you know, just a small amount of loss can have a big impact on how fast that herd can grow. But suffice it to say, I believe it was about 330 individuals in that northern herd. And the Jackson County herd, Black River herd, around 115 animals. So think together over 400 animals now in two distinct populations. So hopefully we're hitting some peaks here.
Let's take another call. Ned from Greenville. Thanks for waiting, Ned. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just had a question about those deer farms and CWD. And when they discover a deer has CWD in the farm, then they shut down like baiting in that county and all surrounding counties. And I guess my thought is that the farms are what bought it, the disease here. And I don't know why they don't maybe make the farms double fence so you don't get nose-to-nose contact with the wild deer herd was one of the questions.
Yeah. Well, what do you think, David?
I'll start off, and Jamie, certainly jump in if you want to. So part of this is the deer farms are under the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, or DADCAP. The free-ranging wild deer management is under the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So it's two different state agencies. And that's part of the reason, because the farm deer are looked at more as an agricultural commodity. There is a lobby. If you go down to some parts of the southern United States and Texas, for example, the lobby for captive wildlife is extremely strong. And that is part of the issue as well. There are regulations for deer farms that are pretty strict. So, for example, I think they have to double fence. And if CWD is found on the farm, that farm gets what's called depopulated, or essentially they'll come and they'll eradicate all the animals on that farm to try to control the spread of the disease. I think the prevailing thought is that perhaps CWD was started with captive cervid farming, but that is not necessarily the case. I don't believe, it's the transmission of CWD, how it's transmitted, how long it stays in the environment and things like that. I think there's a pretty good sense about some of that, but it's not definitive. The science is not definitive in all of that. And so there are some unknowns. As with most of the wildlife management, especially controversial issues, it's not just a biological management issue. It's a political issue. It's a human-based issue and things like that. And so I think that's some of what you're seeing as well, with some of these captive deer farms.
Jamie, anything to add?
No, I think that really covered what I was going to touch on, too.
Thanks, Ned. Appreciate your call. Dennis in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, good afternoon. Good morning. Afternoon, there it is. Yeah, I got it. My question was just on woodpeckers, both the downy kind and the redheaded one. Is when do they head south, and when can I take my feeder down? I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay.
I'll take that one. So we have a variety of woodpecker species in the state of Wisconsin. I think we have 9 total woodpecker species. The downies are very, very common. They're a small black and white, predominantly black and white woodpecker, sometimes confused with hairy woodpeckers, although downies are much more common in the state of Wisconsin than hairies are. Downies are here year-round, and they will utilize the food source you put out for them, be it suet, nuts, seed, whatever the case might be. Redheaded woodpeckers can be seasonal, although sometimes they can stay here year-round depending on what time or what the winter is like and where you are in the state. Redheaded woodpeckers typically tend to migrate out of our area more commonly and are one of the more common migratory woodpecker species. But most of the woodpecker species in our state are year-round residents, and they're active 12 months of the year.
All right. Let's take a question from Mark next from Wisconsin Rapids and said he thinks one preventive measure for keeping chronic wasting disease down would be to have a nice, healthy wolf population. Mark said he'd be more than willing to pay tax dollars necessary to compensate farmers and ranchers for losses rather than having a wolf hunt. So that was his comment.
Yeah, and I think we see that, we see that comment quite frequently. I think one thing that comes to mind right away with that is that the prevalence of chronic wasting disease does not overlap so tightly with the wolf distribution in the state. And yet I'm not sure we really want to be moving wolves into the areas where we have chronic wasting disease, because that's also where we tend to have a lot more livestock farms as well.
And I think if you talk to the deer hunting population, that they have a completely different perspective on that. And that's a pretty frequent complaint from the deer hunting population, is that the wolves are eating all the deer, and that's why they're not seeing deer during the deer season. So, and then the only other question the other comment I'll make about Mark's response there is there is a compensation fund in place. So if wolves do depredate cattle, for example, or bear hunting dogs, for example, that the owner of the cattle or the dog is able to apply to the state. And if it's deemed that the wolf actually is the one that depredated that animal, they can claim monetary compensation.
All right. There you go. We have something called, this is a totally different topic here. We have something called the Endangered Resources License Plates. The DNR has that right now. And you can get a good deal on them right now, as a matter of fact, and maybe talk a bit about those.
Yeah, I'll take this. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, one of the ways that they generate revenue is to sell specialty license plates here in the state of Wisconsin, and you'll see them. The most recent one has a bald eagle coming in with its talons out. It's a really, actually, pretty attractive plate, I think. But since 1995, they've been selling endangered resources license plates. And depending on the year, sometimes those license plate sales have accounted for up to 40% of funding for endangered species conservation in the state of Wisconsin. And it's supported recovery, for example, bald eagles, trumpeter swans, things of that nature. Any endangered species will benefit from the sale of these license plates. And so the license plate for an endangered resource plate costs $40. $15 of that goes to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, and $25 goes to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Endangered Resources Fund. After the first purchase of the, after the first year of purchase, so after you've bought that plate the first year, the second year you have to pay a $25 donation to keep the plate. And that donation is then transferred from the Wisconsin Department of Transportation over to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Endangered Resource Fund. So for a time being, there's an offer for a $25 rebate. So the rebate offer is available until the end of this year, so until December 31st. But anybody who buys a new endangered resources license plate, or for current license plate holders who switch from one plate design to another, you can apply for the rebate, and $25 will be returned to you of that license fee. So it's a really good deal for you. It's an awesome way to demonstrate that you support endangered resource conservation and management. And it's a really good deal for a lot of the endangered resources and endangered species in our state of Wisconsin.
My license plate is looking pretty scruffy right now.
is the time, Larry. Replace your license plate with a new design and get $25 back.
I keep thinking that they're going to send me a new plate one of these years, and instead I just get the sticker. So maybe I'm just going to have to and of course, I always put a donation in on my tax forms to the Endangered Resources Fund, but this might be another way to do double duty for me, for sure. Oh man, the special is running because of Bat Week.
Well, go on, Jamie.
No, I was just going to say they were just kind of throwing out this rebate in conjunction with Bat Week, which was the last week in October. Always is, and they were just kind of throwing out this rebate because it really is helping. So the money that's collected is helping our cave bat species that are threatened right now and in great peril, really. So yeah, it was a way to kind of highlight the license plate program and some of the where the funding goes.
And Bat Week is a method for just creating awareness about bats.
Yep. Yeah, it's an opportunity to draw people's attention to bats. I mean, obviously, you know, we are bombarded in the public with all sorts of different news and items and things like that. And so it's just an opportunity to concentrate people's attention on bats. And especially right now, you know, bats are migrating either out of our state, or those four species that hibernate, they're moving into hibernation if they haven't already. And so it's just an opportunity to kind of also highlight that transition between bats being active in our state and bats being either absent or not active in our state.
And back to the license plate for you, how do we take advantage of that special opportunity to, you know, where you go online, or how does that work?
Yeah, if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, their license plate application form, and then you can download and print off a $25 rebate coupon from the DNR's website.
Okay, there we go. Earlier on in the late spring and summer months, we heard that birds were dying of a mysterious disease across eastern Wisconsin. Anything updating on that?
Nope. They're still thinking that that was tied to the cicada hatch, which is a 17-year cycle. And that was cicada hatch was much more prevalent out east in the eastern part of the United States than it was here in the Midwest. But they still think that it had something to do with the cicada hatch. But as a result of the bird die-off and them not quite sure what was going on, they were trying to not concentrate birds around feeding sources such as bird feeders. And so out of just a bunch of caution, they asked people to take bird feeders down, especially in the summer months when birds really don't need that concentrated food source coming from the bird feeder. So they were asking people to take bird feeders down so they don't concentrate birds in small areas and potentially transfer that disease quicker across the bird population. But now that caution is relaxed and they're saying to people, if you want to put the bird feeders back up, please do. And especially I know that that's a very popular activity amongst people, and especially in the winter. People are very, very concerned about bird welfare and health in the wintertime and enjoy seeing them at the feeders, especially with the backdrop of white snow and things like that. So we just wanted to let people know that if you're interested in putting your bird feeders back up and you haven't heard the news, you're more than welcome to reinstall the bird feeders and enjoy watching them come to your feeder all winter long.
And I think Scott Craven told me that the prices were down a little bit on some of the more popular seeds.
He would be the one to know, and I have noticed the same thing. So, again, if you haven't listened to our shows, buy a high-quality seed rather than a commercial mix. And if you were going to buy only one seed, pick a black-oiled sunflower seed and feed that. So I also really go through the shelled peanut pieces.
Birds do?
No, I don't eat them. But the birds really do prefer those two seeds or nuts.
Yep.
And in the last minute or two that we've got, I want to go back to those apps because, Jamie, you said you had a few more apps you wanted to mention.
Well, first of all, we could probably all ask our children what apps are out there. But if we're talking about nature-based apps, use this as a hook to get your kids outside with their smartphones. So a couple other ones I came across, one called All Trails. And once you download it and you open up the app, you can just type in your location, so Madison, Wisconsin, and it will populate with a map of all sorts of walking trails in that general area. So no matter where you're traveling, go ahead and use that app to find some trails to catch. And another one would be geocaching, especially with kids. So no matter where you travel, people have little caches hidden where you download the geocache app. And then again, you're traveling, you're over in Rhinelander, you can go on that website, type in your location, and it'll show you caches in the area that you can go then try to find and navigate. Usually they're in, natural areas and so on. So that would be another one. And don't forget that you can download, instead of music, maybe nature sounds. So there's a lot of apps that feature nature sounds. And so if you like to listen to music or the radio before bed, maybe you can find a new app that provides nature sounds and set a timer and fall asleep that way. So lots of options.
Lots of options out there, and it's always fun to have you guys come by and talk, and I really appreciate your time here. Thanks so much for being with us. And by the way, I think Natalie put up that whole list of the apps. I believe we have that up on our website, so if you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry and then go to today's program notes, you're going to find all of those, how to get all of those apps right at our site. Well, Jamie, David, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. Look forward to your next visit in January.
That sounds good, Larry. Thank you so much.
David Drake and Jamie Nack will be back in January. I think Scott Craven's going to be with us in the month of December. Thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.